My name is Michael McCusker. A bit of a potpourri this morning. I'd like to start it out with a letter to the Daily Astorian I've written, which they may or may not print. And, of course, it is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the cosmos. To the editor. The Astoria School Board, in its decision to kill public health care for city school students, is reminiscent of its infamous counterpart, the Kansas City School Board, that continues to deny evolution. Also, those people in Texas who seem to have a hypocritical stranglehold on school textbooks come to mind. Although the great majority of persons who attended the May 8th school board meeting were in favor of school-based healthcare centers, the board nixed the possibility by a 3-2 majority. Why? Apparently because of a fear engendered about contraceptives for girls, as well as abortions without parental knowledge or consent, which might be the local equivalent of the spurious claim of death panels impugned to Obamacare, or the overblown frenzy about gun control that the U.S. Senate responded to in its defeat of firearm registration, despite approval of perhaps 80 or more percent of Americans. And the Oregon State Senate has tabled all gun control legislation this session. So here in Astoria, similar dubious guile and partisan sophistry hijack children's opportunities for public health care. Three school board members either folded under political pressure or were never going to sanction a health care center in the first place. They tabled the idea supposedly forever. The most disturbing aspect will be if everyone gives up. The parents of the children killed at a Connecticut school last December were very unhappy with the Senate vote, but they are not quitting their crusade to regulate gun sales. Neither should the parents and students who believe a school-based health care center is a solid idea. The students probably won't give up, nor should the adults, despite how often they might be rebuffed. It might take a while and bruise some egos and ideologies. Fortunately, there is an election this month, which includes three positions on the Astoria School Board. The majority of voters just might elect advocates of the health care center and reverse the current board's imprudent decision, as reformist Clatsop County commissioners have altered the prospects of LNG. Paradoxically, if indeed corporatist muscle prevails and LNG trumps the will of the people, as well might Riverside coal export terminals also, public health care will probably be necessary for nearly everybody. And that was a letter I wrote, which may or may not be published by the Daily Astorian. And if it is published, it might be after the election, which is this next week. So get your ballots in. If indeed you hear background noise like sirens, which I am hearing, it is springtime and I have the windows in this generally sealed-off studio open. So we might hear sirens, bees buzz, people talking, who knows. And it is spring, and so I'd like to read an annual, just like the plants that are growing, or semi-annual. I don't think I read it every year, but there have been so many cases about abuse of youth in the area, or at least headlines in the newspapers, that I thought I'd read this one. Some fellow even tried to kidnap a girl in the City Library, I understand. I call it the Virgins of Spring. And again, the disclaimer holds. And I start with a couple of quotes. The first by Maurice Chevalier, "Thank heaven for little girls." and J.M. Coetzee from his book Waiting for the Barbarians. When I was young, the mere smell of a woman would arouse me. Now it is evidently only the sweetest, the youngest, the newest who have that power. One of these days, it will be little boys. Spring. Time for the ritual festivals of fertility. The interminable spectacles of middle-aged men of various fraternal orders fawning over the season's virginal young princesses while obliterating any resemblance to the age-old carnality of these annual rites of fecundity. And there were two courts of princesses in Astoria yesterday, the Rose Festival, among them, from Portland. Humanity's biological clock does not keep the same tempo as its intellectual designs. We are still pagan savages underneath our surface dust of civilized society. Our ancient fertility rituals are layered in antiseptic disguises that reflect a rigidly puritanical and sexually repressed culture, despite MTV and the movies. Our libertine male ancestors, elders of various tribes or clans, demanded first crack at every spring's virgins, and later, within reach of our own era, noblesse oblige gave a local baron the right to consummate a marriage with the virgin bride of a peasant. Old bulls in the natural world fight young stags for amatory dominance over a plurality of females. Old bulls in the contrived human world compete with hair implants and sporty automobiles. Older men have always wanted to mate with young girls, not from nostalgia for lost youth, but to consolidate aging and vitiated genes with strong, robust genes, maintaining a vigorous heredity by minimizing the disadvantages of worn-out RNA. Although the desire for young lambs is socially degenerate, it reflects age-old lust and determination to survive through greater genetic diaspora. However, for the same reason, older men strive to preserve their reproductive vitality and biological imperative. Few younger women are willing to risk impairing their own genetic possibilities with old dogs past their prime. After all, randy young men are strong and eminently virile and potent bulls yet, and offer the best opportunity for sturdy stock. As a woman wrote once, sperm is cheap, eggs are expensive. The sexual desire of older men and women for girls and boys is an insensate desire, a primeval siren's call to invigorate reproductivity. However, like individual body cells, each person's purposes and depravities are their own. Children throughout history have been initiated early to sex, more often as not by adults. Only recently has society prolonged sexual abstinence, just as it has prolonged childhood itself. Laws and social restrictions are designed to prevent promiscuous older persons from debauching children, especially to keep predatory males off the bodies of young girls until they grow old enough to make their own choices of mates. Older men and women, in consequence, stifle their sexual desires for the young in fear of social disapproval and legal vengeance, and sublimate them in other ways. But those who do not are very often explosive with their thwarted desires and become deviant and violent in pursuit of them. The manner in which child abuse is treated drives predators underground and into more violent acts. The strictures that attempt to protect children are quite likely perpetrators of the grotesque molestation and sexual murders of children. Pornography, promiscuity, and pedophilia are results of sexual repression and are in turn demanded to be suppressed. A civilization out of control breeds violence and insecurity, which is taken out on children by neurotic, bitter adults. Movies, documentaries, groups of parents, and others throughout the country advocate for laws for greater protection of children, yet abuse flourishes underground. There is, as an article in Time magazine alluded to a few years ago, a, quote, preoccupation with child abuse in an age when lurid lyrics, sniggering sitcoms, and trash-talking stars work hard to rob children of innocence. The sexually abusive parent, guardian, or family friend is not only a predator in his own right, but also a stand-in for all the gaudy malevolence of pop culture. The public reacts with wide eyes and a bit of drool at the corner of the mouth. And that's Time Magazine. The public gets to be puritanical and voyeuristic at the same time, the article said. The attitude is basically, this food is terrible and there's not enough of it. James R. Kincaid, author of Child Loving, The Erotic Child and Victorian Culture, wrote in a New York Times op-ed piece, The story our culture feels it deserves would allow us to speak endlessly about child sexuality and the sexual attraction of children for others, while maintaining our distance from these lurid tales. The moving story of how parents affirm the unspeakableness of sexual interest in children by speaking of it frequently. For thousands of years, it was acceptable for adults to have sexual relations with children, with a few exceptions, such as Native American cultures, which regarded child sexual abuse as a capital crime. Children have since antiquity been raised for sex, as slaves for purposes of prepubescent prostitution, or more insidiously, for personal sexualities such as incest. Only recently has intensifying concern and a collective sense of shame about child sexual seduction initiated a campaign to prevent and punish it, and in particular to warn and protect children. The law attempts to protect children essentially because they don't have the intellectual maturity to differentiate between what feels good and what is good. These laws are specific. It is against the law for any adult to engage in any form of sexual activity with a child under any circumstances, even if the child initially tried to attract the adult or assented to sex with an adult. One woman expressed eloquently the public's inflamed anger at the surge of child molestation. If anyone messed with my daughters, she said, I would nail his penis to a stump in the middle of the woods, set the stump afire, hand him a rusty axe, and walk away. Child molesters do not sexually abuse children because they are depraved, but because of opportunity. Prison does not change pederasts' attraction for children, and eventually they get out of jail. In a number of states, child molesters who have served their sentences are being kept behind bars, which is unconstitutional, and which many believe addresses a flaw in the legal system through the back door. Convicted child abusers are also targeted with emblems that identify them as molesters once released from prison, in the manner early American colonial Puritans publicly marked sexual deviants. Yet the problem remains. What should be done with pedophiles who will commit such acts again and again? Given the choice of pardoning a child molester, the public would most likely set the serial murderer Barabbas free. Following a long period of neglect, public antipathy toward child abuse, whether sexual or violent, or both, has swung to the extreme, making almost any adult contact with children suspect, which only severs connections between generations that are perhaps the most necessary links for human continuity other than reproduction. Hitler's policy of turning children against their parents was never as successful alienating generations as the potential suspicion between young and old is apt to be in regard to pederasty. We seem obsessed with denying our children exposure to things they most want to know and will eventually know on their own. We disregard our own youthful impatience to learn and grow up and inflict identical deceits we endured upon our children. We wish to shield them from unpleasant realities and attempt to forcibly repress their sexuality, yet we expect them to somehow cope. A recent book criticizes the fearful overprotection of children from sexual knowledge and experience, faulting the anti-sex puritanism of our culture, and defends adult child sex as indispensable to sexual awakening. Reaction to the book has obviously been shrill, bordering on revulsion and hysteria. The reflexive response is to ban the book. But it's meant to be controversial. There is no debate and no democracy without controversy. As Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the cornerstone of the First Amendment is the free and unfettered assertion of thoughts and beliefs, even, quote, expressions of opinion that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. The mass molestation of boys and a few girls by Catholic priests has intensified the controversy over adult child sex, but it has also raised the unholy specter of homophobia as a response, which distorts the real problem of adults exploiting their authority to coerce children into fornication that is equivalent to rape. A universal dilemma is that the intense and dynamic sexual magnetism of young males and females to draw them toward each other for propagation radiates so strongly that it pulls in many more than just a few old fools unable to resist the lure. That seductive charisma is a reason we personally and culturally not only worship youth and baldly exploit it, once past its manic angst, but define the rest of our lives by the short period we are young. Human beings are middle-aged and old nearly twice as long as being young. Average life expectancy is 3.5 score plus. I'm 2 years past. I'm on my own now. Youth really has only a single purpose, to grow, mate, and propagate. The rest of life is tending succeeding generations and attempting to prepare a better world for them than we currently live in, an essential goal and hope of every generation. Children have more to worry about than more recent generations of their elders, perhaps an instinctive premonition that the species might have little time left on the planet is leading to much younger sexual contact, reminiscent of the greater part of our history when the average person seldom lived past 30 or 40. Or it might be a desperate measure to circumvent AIDS, which fatally attacks at the very organs of procreation. The virtually uncontaminated bodies of children who are barely mature might be subliminally designated to carry and preserve the seed of the species. This might also be a partial, if insufficient, explanation for the rise of child molestation by adults. So we sanitize our public sexual ceremonies in the same manner we act unconscious of the implications of dressing little girls to resemble women and dress older women as prepubescents. Catalogs for children's apparel display girls seductively modeling sexy dresses, midriff revealing blouses and shirts and tight pants, as well as nightwear, which are designed and marketed by adults. We are, however, a contradictory species. At the same instant we arouse the ancient lust for young girls and, or, boys, we act aggressively against child molestation. We ruthlessly strip the ancient fertility festivals of overt carnality while older men pantomime with much flair and flim-flam the covert seduction of ceremonial queens selected from among virgin princesses to rule imaginary courts of spring, Scandinavia, roses, or regatta. Only fools and hypocrites deny the attractions of the beautiful young. Young women and men are among the grandest creatures on earth. We all love youth, reproductively, restoratively, and retrospectively. The distinctions between abusive touching of our young and caresses that reflect love and respect are necessary for all of us to know. Dreams and attractions are out of our control. Our responses to them are not. And that was something I wrote, The Virgins of Spring. I'd like to read now an article from the New York Times from Sunday, April 21st, 1 month into spring, 2013. It's What Do the Birders Know? And it's by Brian Kimberly. A bird watcher is a kind of pious predator. To see a new bird is to capture it metaphorically, and a rare bird, or an FOY, first of the year for the initiated, is a kind of trophy. A list of birds seen on a given day is also a form of prayer, a thanksgiving for being alive at a certain time and place. Posting that list online is a 21st century form of a votive offering. It's unclear what deity presides. There was prestige in knowing birds in ancient Rome, and there is prestige today. There are also competitive insect enthusiasts and tree connoisseurs and fungus aficionados, but they lack the cultural stature and sheer numbers of bird watchers. There are 5.8 million bird watchers in the United States, slightly more than the number of Americans in book clubs or residents of Wisconsin. That's a huge army of primitive hunter mystics decked out in sturdy hiking boots and nylon rain gear, consulting their smartphones to identify or imitate a particular quarry. There is nothing especially new about them except for their gear. 200 years ago, the heartland teemed with second sons of wealthy European families who could have stayed home dissipating in traditional style, but chose to go to the New World and find a new animal instead. Reporting your sightings to the Audubon Society is decidedly less glamorous than dispatching a new specimen to a museum in Paris or London, but it is a kindred enterprise. Today's birders are not exploring new territory geographically as the early naturalists did. Rather, they are contouring the frontiers of climate change. It's April, and now May, and the kitchen window bird observer is limbering up too. Are the birds nesting early, nesting late? Do they know something we don't? The reporting such observers do is crucial. And what are today's birds telling us? The Audubon Society estimates that nearly 60% of 305 bird species found in North America in winter are shifting northward and to higher elevations in response to climate change. For comparison, imagine the inhabitants of 30 states, using state residents as a proxy for species of American human, becoming disgruntled with forest fires and drought and severe weather events and seeking out suitable new habitat. The Audubon Society's estimates rest largely on data supplied by volunteers in citizen science projects like the Christmas Bird Count, first proposed in 1900, 9 years after the first known use of the word birdwatcher, to set the hobby apart from the more traditional Christmas pastime of shooting birds. The birds in question have shifted an average of 35 miles north over a period of about 40 years, seemingly insignificant in human terms, but a major move ecologically. Such documentation, drawing on databases and the practices of citizen science, is descended from folk wisdom, where birds are ascribed a certain predictive power. Folk wisdom holds that they nest high in anticipation of warm weather, not true, or fly low when they expect to get wet, true. Folk wisdom has deep roots. Auspice and augury share a Latin origin with avian. An augur was a priest in ancient Rome who studied birds to determine the will of the gods. Cicero was one. When an elected official is inaugurated today, he or she is etymologically promoted to birdwatcher in chief. Mr. President, your binoculars. There are no accidental hawks or eagles in the Iliad or the Odyssey either. This says more about humans than about birds. They remind us of time, hence the venerable history of the cuckoo clock. As James Baldwin noted, the whisper beneath the word time is death. The ancient wisdom of fretting obsessively over bird behavior has obtained the vindication of modern science. Hawks and eagles do not appear by accident. When, where, and whether they appear is absolutely a portent. The spotted owl is a bioindicator, a species that can be used to monitor the condition of an ecosystem. In other words, bioindicator is just modern parlance for omen. And so the practice of birdwatching, no matter how geared up and teched out, cannot escape its ancient roots, or rather, it has come back around. Birds are not moving north in anticipation of climate change. Rather, they are moving in response to it. Still, they are becoming predictive in a manner not founded in superstition, but well documented in reported behavior. We can't escape trying to see the future through birds. Too many canaries were deployed to detect gas leaks in coal mines. Too many ravens launched from ships to find land. Bird anxiety is an essential component of the human predicament. There is no telling what kinds of perverse ecological arrangements we will create for birds in the future, or what new technologies will be introduced to birdwatching. Google Glass, for example, has implications, and binoculars that double as digital or online field guides can't be far away. We have reached an era when our instincts, anxieties, and gadgets collide. Our classical relationship with birds is reinforced, and our understanding is enhanced. Unfortunately, we may need to start moving north. And that was What Do the Birders Know? By Brian Kimberling, who's the author of the forthcoming novel, Snapper. And this was published in the New York Times, Sunday, April 21st, 2013. And now I'd like to read a letter from the Tillamook Headlight Herald for Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. It was written by Marjorie Miller, Tillamook, Oregon. Please don't kill bees. I am making a plea for honeybees. Do you know how important they are to our lives? If they go, we go. They are that important. Please, don't spray your yard or garden. It's important. And that was Marjorie Miller, Tillamook, Oregon. So, there you are. The birds and the bees this morning. And that was a very potent letter. I especially like her line, if they go, we go. Now I'd like to read another letter to a newspaper. This is to the Daily Astorian, and it was printed March 1st, 2013. I'm a little late on it. It was written by Carrie G. Hawley, and I'm sure many of you know Carrie. Get rid of taboos. I strongly feel that my time has come to act in public as a role model for public discourse on this subject of child sexual abuse. A recent Sports Illustrated article about the molestation of two prominent athletes quotes FBI statistics. 1 in 10 men are sexual predators, but only 3% of them are caught. They are usually a family member and male, such as a father, uncle, or brother. 1 in 5 of us are most likely survivors of molestation as children. This is a widespread tragedy not only for the survivors, but also for the sexual predators and their loved ones. There is incredible denial and disassociation involved. My father was a prominent Idaho surgeon. My mother was a lab technician and socialite. I was supported and nurtured by them throughout my parochial education and at Stanford University and Harvard Graduate School of Design. I have since been a peer specialist for 20 years. What I have to say now is extremely difficult and wrenching for me, but must be said. In one life-shattering moment, I confronted my father about his sexual violation of me as a child. Upon his admitting, yes, that he did it, I immediately forgave him. This trauma and his subsequent denial led to many years of mental health hospitalizations and my courageous return to society, only to be squelched by further denial and silence. Given silence and incredible remorse that was so pervasive in me as a child with my father, it is no wonder I acted out in self-mutilation and petty fire-setting. I am very loyal to the memory of my now deceased parents. To me, the very last thought in my young mind was prison for any of my family. Last spring, my brother's denial of my childhood events led to another hospitalization, after which I was left with months of suicidal despondency. We are slowly learning to overcome taboos about talking about both sexuality and incest. We can no longer afford 1 in 10 men to be so demonized as to prevent the children from seeking help. My partner of 22 years and I have overcome many problems together resulting from our childhood sexual, emotional, and/or physical abuse that has seriously impacted our lives. I am grateful to all my friends in the community and at the Women's Resource Center who have provided such strong support and help. I now have the courage not only to be open, but also to be who I am. Out of gratitude to our community, I have also served with Victory Over Child Abuse Camps. And that was by Carrie Hawley of Astoria. And I have his permission to read this. As a matter of fact, I He had hoped I would. And I guess we've gone full circle, this program, from beginning to end. And this has been Michael McCusker. It's a rather gray and going to be rainy, typical spring in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon coast day. I will probably be here next Thursday if the sky doesn't fall or I plunge into the river and find myself stroking out across the bar, or if maybe some drone finds me on a sidewalk and turns me to ash.